Ghostly shapes of hundreds and hundreds of tents rising up the gentle slope of a large field toward a dark wood on the horizon. They said goodbye to the diggeries and approached the cottage door. A man was standing in the doorway, looking out at the tents. Harry knew at a glance that this was the only real Muggle for several acres. When he heard their footsteps, he turned his head to look at them.
"Morning," said Mr. Weasley brightly. "Morning," said the Muggle. "Would you be Mr. Roberts?"
"Aye, I would," said Mr. Roberts. "And who are you?"
"Weasley, two tents, booked a couple of days ago."
"Aye,"
said Mr. Roberts, consulting a list tacked to the door.
"You got a space up by the wood there, just the one night."
"That's it," said Mr. Weasley.
"You'll be paying now, then,"
said Mr. Roberts.
Right, certainly,"
said Mr. Weasley. He retreated a short distance from the cottage and beckoned Harry toward him.
"Help me, Harry,"
he muttered, pulling a roll of Muggle money from his pocket and starting to peel the notes apart.
"This one's a 10? Ah, yes, I see the little number on it now. So this is a 5.
"A 20, Harry corrected him in an undertone, uncomfortably aware of Mr. Roberts trying to catch every word.
"Ah, yes, so it is. I don't know these little bits of paper."
"You foreign?"
said Mr. Roberts, as Mr. Weasley returned with the correct notes.
"Foreign?"
repeated Mr. Weasley, puzzled.
"You're not the first one who's had trouble with money,"
said Mr. Roberts, scrutinizing Mr. Weasley closely.
"I had two try and pay me with great gold coins the size of hubcaps 10 minutes ago."
"Did you really?"
said Mr. Weasley nervously. Mr. Roberts rummaged around in a tin for some change.
"Never been this crowded,"
he said suddenly, looking out over the misty field again.
"Hundreds of pre-bookings. People usually just turn up."
"Is that right?"
said Mr. Weasley, his hand held out for his change. But Mr. Roberts didn't give it to him.
"Aye," he said thoughtfully. "People from all over. Loads of foreigners. Not just foreigners. Weirdos, you know. There's a bloke walking round in a kilt and a poncho."
"Shouldn't he?"
said Mr. Weasley anxiously.
"It's like some sort of, I don't know, like some sort of rally,"
said Mr. Roberts.
"They all seem to know each other, like a big party."
At that moment, a wizard in plus fours appeared out of thin air next to Mr. Roberts' front door.
"Obliviate,"
he said sharply, pointing his wand at Mr. Roberts. Instantly, Mr. Roberts' eyes slid out of focus, his brows unknitted, and a look of dreamy unconcern fell over his face. Harry recognized the symptoms of one who has just had his memory modified.
"A map of a campsite for you,"
Mr. Roberts said placidly to Mr. Weasley,
"and your change."
"Thanks very much,"
said Mr. Weasley. The wizard in plus fours accompanied them toward the gate to the campsite. He looked exhausted. His chin was blue with stubble, and there were deep purple shadows under his eyes. Once out of earshot of Mr. Roberts, he muttered to Mr. Weasley,
"Been having a lot of trouble with him. Needs a memory charm 10 times a day to keep him happy. And Ludo Bagman's not helping. Trotting around talking about bludgers and quaffles at the top of his voice. Not a worry about anti-Muggle security. Blimey, I'll be glad when this is over. See you later, Arthur."
He disapparated.
"I thought Mr. Bagman was head of magical games and sports," said Ginny, looking surprised. "He should know better than to talk about bludgers near Muggles, shouldn't he?"
"He should," said Mr. Weasley, smiling, and leading them through the gates into the campsite. "But Ludo's always been a bit, well, lax about security. You couldn't wish for a more enthusiastic head of the sports department, though. He played Quidditch for England himself, you know, and he was the best beater the Wimborne Wasps ever had."
They trudged up the misty field between long rows of tents. Most looked almost ordinary. Their owners had clearly tried to make them as Muggle-like as possible, but had slipped up by adding chimneys or bell pulls or weather vanes. However, here and there was a tent so obviously magical that Harry could hardly be surprised that Mr. Roberts was getting suspicious. Halfway up the field stood an extravagant confection of striped silk, like a miniature palace, with several live peacocks tethered at the entrance.
A little farther on they passed a tent that had 3 floors and several turrets, and a short way beyond that was a tent that had a front garden attached, complete with bird bath, sundial, and fountain.
"Always the same," said Mr. Weasley, smiling. "We can't resist showing off when we get together. Ah, here we are. Look, this is us."
They had reached the very edge of the wood at the top of the field, and here was an empty space, with a small sign hammered into the ground that read, W-E-E-Z-L-Y.
"Couldn't have a better spot," said Mr. Weasley happily. "The field is just on the other side of the wood there. We're as close as we could be."
He hoisted his backpack from his shoulders.
"Right," he said excitedly. "No magic allowed. Strictly speaking, not when we're out in these numbers on Muggle land. We'll be putting these tents up by hand. Shouldn't be too difficult. Muggles do it all the time. Here, Harry, where do you reckon we should start?"
Harry had never been camping in his life. The Dursleys had never taken him on any kind of holiday, preferring to leave him with Mrs. Fig, an old neighbour. However, he and Hermione worked out where most of the poles and pegs should go, and though Mr. Weasley was more of a hindrance than a help, because he got thoroughly overexcited when it came to using the mallet, they finally managed to erect a pair of shabby 2-man tents. All of them stood back to admire their handiwork. Nobody looking at these tents would guess they belonged to wizards, Harry thought. But the trouble was that once Bill, Charlie, and Percy arrived, they would be a party of 10. Hermione seemed to have spotted this problem, too. She gave Harry a quizzical look as Mr. Weasley dropped to his hands and knees and entered the first tent.
"We'll be a bit cramped," he called, "but I think we'll all squeeze in. Come and have a look."
Harry bent down, ducked under the tent flap, and felt his jaw drop. He had walked into what looked like an old-fashioned 3-room flat, complete with bathroom and kitchen. Oddly enough, it was furnished in exactly the same sort of style as Mrs. Fig's house. There were crocheted covers on the mismatched chairs, and a strong smell of cats.
"Well, it's not for long," said Mr.
Weasley, mopping his bald patch with a handkerchief and peering in at the 4 bunk beds that stood in the bedroom.
"I borrowed this from Perkins at the office. Doesn't camp much any more, poor fellow. He's got lumbago."
He picked up the dusty kettle and peered inside it.
"We'll need water."
"There's a tap marked on this map the Muggle gave us," said Ron, who had followed Harry inside the tent and seemed completely unimpressed by its extraordinary inner proportions. "It's on the other side of the field."
"Well, why don't you, Harry and Hermione, go and get us some water then?"
Mr. Weasley handed over the kettle and a couple of saucepans.
"And the rest of us will get some wood for a fire."
"But we've got an oven," said Ron.
"Why can't we just—"
"Ron, anti-Muggle security," said Mr.
Weasley, his face shining with anticipation.
"When real Muggles camp, they cook on fires outdoors. I've seen them at it."
After a quick tour of the girls' tent, which was slightly smaller than the boys', though without the smell of cats, Harry, Ron, and Hermione set off across the campsite with the kettle and saucepans. Now, with the sun newly risen and the mist lifting, they could see the city of tents that stretched in every direction. They made their way slowly through the rows, staring eagerly around. It was only just dawning on Harry how many witches and wizards there must be in the world. He had never really thought much about those in other countries. Their fellow campers were starting to wake up. First to stir were the families with small children. Harry had never seen witches and wizards this young before. A tiny boy, no older than 2, was crouched outside a large pyramid-shaped tent, holding a wand and poking happily at a slug in the grass, which was swelling slowly to the size of a salami. As they drew level with him, his mother came hurrying out of the tent.
"How many times, Kevin, you don't touch Daddy's wand? Yuck!"
She had trodden on the giant's slug, which burst. Her scolding carried after them on the still air, mingling with the little boy's yells,
"You bust slug! You bust slug!"
A short way further on, they saw 2 little witches, barely older than Kevin, who were riding toy broomsticks that rose only high enough for the girls' toes to skim the dewy grass. A ministry wizard had already spotted them. As he hurried past Harry, Ron, and Hermione, he muttered distractedly,
"In broad daylight. Parents having a lie-in, I suppose."
Here and there adult wizards and witches were emerging from their tents and starting to cook breakfast. Some, with furtive looks around them, conjured fires with their wands. Others were striking matches with dubious looks on their face, as though sure this couldn't work. Three African wizards sat in serious conversation, all of them wearing long white robes and roasting what looked like a rabbit on a bright purple fire, while a group of middle-aged American witches sat gossiping happily beneath a spangled banner stretched between their tents that read, "The Salem Witches Institute." Harry caught snatches of conversation in strange languages from the inside of tents they passed, and though he couldn't understand a word, the tone of every single voice was excited.
Is it my eyes, or has everything gone green? Said Ron.
It wasn't just Ron's eyes. They had walked into a patch of tents that were all covered with a thick growth of shamrocks, so that it looked as though small, oddly shaped hillocks had sprouted out of the earth. Grinning faces could be seen under those that had their flaps open. Then, from beneath them, they heard their names.
Harry! Ron! Hermione!
It was Seamus Finnegan, their fellow griffin of fourth year. He was sitting in front of his own shamrock-covered tent with a sandy-haired woman who had to be his mother and his best friend Dean Thomas, also of Gryffindor.
"Like the decorations," said Seamus, grinning. "The ministry's not too happy." "Ach, why shouldn't we show our colours?" said Mrs. Finnegan. "You should see what the Bulgarians have got dangling all over their tents. You'll be supporting Ireland, of course,"
she added, eyeing Harry, Ron and Hermione beadily. When they had assured her that they were indeed supporting Ireland, they set off again, though, as Ron said,
"Like we'd say anything else surrounded by that lot." "I wonder what the Bulgarians have got dangling all over their tents," said Hermione.
"Let's go and have a look," said Harry, pointing to a large patch of tents upfield, where the Bulgarian flag, white, green and red, was fluttering in the breeze. The tents here had not been bedecked with plant life, but each and every one of them had the same poster attached to it, a poster of a very surly face with heavy black eyebrows. The picture was, of course, moving, but all it did was blink and scowl.
"Crumb," said Ron quietly.
"What?" said Hermione.
"Crumb," said Ron.
"Victor Crumb, the Bulgarian seeker. He looks really grumpy," said Hermione, looking around at the many crumbs blinking and scowling at them.
"Really grumpy?"
Ron raised his eyes to the heavens.
"Who cares what he looks like? He's unbelievable. He's really young, too. Only just 18 or something. He's a genius. You wait until tonight. You'll see."
There was already a small queue for the tap in the corner of the field. Harry, Ron and Hermione joined it, right behind a pair of men who were having a heated argument. One of them was a very old wizard who was wearing a long, flowery nightgown. The other was clearly a ministry wizard. He was holding out a pair of pinstripe trousers and almost crying with exasperation.
"Just put them on, Archie. There's a good chap. You can't walk around like that. The muggle at the gate's already getting suspicious."
"I bought this in a muggle shop," said the old wizard stubbornly. "Muggles wear them."
"Muggle women wear them, Archie, not the men. They wear these," said the ministry wizard, as he brandished the pinstripe trousers.
"I'm not putting them on," said old Archie in indignation. "I like a healthy breeze around my privates, thanks."
Hermione was overcome with such a strong fit of the giggles at this point that she had to duck out of the queue, and only returned when Archie had collected his water and moved away. Walking more slowly now because of the weight of the water, they made their way back through the campsite. Here and there they saw more familiar faces, other Hogwarts students with their families. Oliver Wood, the old captain of Harry's house Quidditch team, who had just left Hogwarts, dragged Harry over to his parents' tent to introduce him, and told him excitedly that he had just been signed to the Puddlemere United reserve team. Next, they were hailed by Ernie McMillan, a Hufflepuff fourth year, and a little further on they saw Cho Chang, a very pretty girl who played Seeker on the Ravenclaw team. She waved and smiled at Harry, who slopped quite a lot of water down his front as he waved back. More to stop Ron from smirking than anything, Harry hurriedly pointed out a large group of teenagers whom he had never seen before.
"Who do you reckon they are?" he said.
They don't go to Hogwarts, do they?
Spec they go to some foreign school, said Ron. I know there are others. Never met anyone who went to one, though. Bill had a pen friend at a school in Brazil. This was years and years ago, and he wanted to go on an exchange trip, but Mum and Dad couldn't afford it. His pen friend got all offended when he said he wasn't going and sent him a cursed hat. It made his ears shrivel up.
Harry laughed, but didn't voice the amazement he felt at hearing about other wizarding schools. He supposed, now that he saw representatives of so many nationalities in the campsite, that he had been stupid never to realize that Hogwarts couldn't be the only one. He glanced at Hermione, who looked utterly unsurprised by the information. No doubt she had run across the news about other wizarding schools in some book or another.
"You've been ages," said George, when they finally got back to the Weasleys' tents. "Met a few people," said Ron, setting the water down. "You not got that fire started yet?"
"Dad's having fun with the matches," said Fred. Mr. Weasley was having no success at all in lighting the fire, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Splintered matches littered the ground around him, but he looked as though he was having the time of his life. "Whoops!" he said, as he managed to light a match and promptly dropped it in surprise.
"Come here, Mr. Weasley," said Hermione kindly, taking the box from him and showing him how to do it properly.
At last they got the fire lit, though it was at least another hour before it was hot enough to cook anything. There was plenty to watch while they waited, however. Their tent seemed to be pitched right alongside a kind of thoroughfare to the field, and ministry members kept hurrying up and down it, greeting Mr. Weasley cordially as they passed. Mr. Weasley kept up a running commentary, mainly for Harry and Hermione's benefit. His own children knew too much about the ministry to be greatly interested.
"That was Cuthbert Mockridge, head of the Goblin Liaison Office. Here comes Gilbert Wimple. He's with the Committee on Experimental Charms. He's had those horns for a while now. Hello, Arnie. Arnold Peasgood. He's an Obliviator, member of the Accidental Magic Reversal Squad, you know. And that's Bode and Croker. They're Unspeakables."
"They're what?"
"From the Department of Mysteries. Top secret. No idea what they get up to."
At last the fire was ready, and they had just started cooking eggs and sausages when Bill, Charlie and Percy came strolling out of the woods toward them.
"Just apparated, Dad," said Percy loudly. "Ah, excellent! Lunch!"
They were halfway through their plates of eggs and sausages when Mr. Weasley jumped to his feet, waving and grinning at a man who was striding toward them.
"Aha!" he said. "The man of the moment, Ludo!"
Ludo Bagman was easily the most noticeable person Harry had seen so far, even including old Archie in his flowered nightdress. He was wearing long Quidditch robes in thick horizontal stripes of bright yellow and black. An enormous picture of a wasp was splashed across his chest. He had the look of a powerfully built man gone slightly to seed. The robes were stretched tightly across a large belly he surely had not had in the days when he had played Quidditch for England. His nose was squashed, probably broken by a stray bludger, Harry thought, but his round blue eyes, short blonde hair, and rosy complexion made him look like a very overgrown schoolboy.
"Ahoy there!"
Bagman called happily. He was walking as though he had springs attached to the balls of his feet, and was plainly in a state of wild excitement.
"Arthur, old man!"
he puffed as he reached the campfire.
"What a day, eh? What a day! Could we have asked for more perfect weather, a cloudless night coming, and hardly a hiccup in the arrangements? Not much for me to do."
Behind him a group of haggard-looking ministry wizards rushed past, pointing at the distant evidence of some sort of magical fire that was sending violet sparks 20 feet into the air. Percy hurried forward with his hand outstretched. Apparently his disapproval of the way Ludo Bagman ran his department did not prevent him from wanting to make a good impression.
"Ah, yes," said Mr. Weasley, grinning. "This is my son, Percy. He's just started at the ministry. This is Fred. No, George, sorry. That's Fred. Bill, Charlie, Ron. My daughter, Ginny, and Ron's friends, Hermione Granger and Harry Potter."
Bagman did the smallest of double takes when he heard Harry's name, and his eyes performed the familiar flick upward to the scar on Harry's forehead.
"Everyone," Mr. Weasley continued, "this is Ludo Bagman. You know who he is. It's thanks to him we've got such good tickets."
Bagman beamed and waved his hand as if to say it had been nothing.
"Fancy a flutter on the match, Arthur?"
he said eagerly, jingling what seemed to be a large amount of gold in the pockets of his yellow and black robes.
"I've already got Roddy Pontner betting me Bulgaria will score first. I offered him nice odds, considering Ireland's front three are the strongest I've seen in years, and little Agatha Timms has put up half shares in her eel farm on a week-long match."
"Oh, go on then," said Mr. Weasley. "Let's see, a galleon on Ireland to win."
"A galleon?"
Ludo Bagman looked slightly disappointed, but recovered himself.
"Very well, very well. Any other takers?"
"They're a bit young to be gambling," said Mr. Weasley. "Molly wouldn't like."
"We'll bet 37 galleons, 15 sickles, 3 newts," said Fred, as he and George quickly pooled all their money, "that Ireland wins, but Victor Crumb gets the snitch. Oh, and we'll throw in a fake wand." "You don't want to go showing Mr. Bagman rubbish like that,"
Percy hissed. But Bagman didn't seem to think the wand was rubbish at all. On the contrary, his boyish face shone with excitement as he took it from Fred, and when the wand gave a loud squawk and turned into a rubber chicken, Bagman roared with laughter.
"Excellent! I haven't seen one that convincing in years. I'd pay 5 galleons for that."
Percy froze in an attitude of stunned disapproval.
"Boys," said Mr. Weasley under his breath, "I don't want you betting. That's all your savings. Your mother..." "Don't be a spoilsport, Arthur," boomed Ludo Bagman, rattling his pockets excitedly. "They're old enough to know what they want. You reckon Ireland will win, but Crumb will get the snitch? Not a chance, boys, not a chance. I'll give you excellent odds on that one. We'll add 5 galleons for the funny one, then, shall we?"
Mr. Weasley looked on helplessly as Ludo Bagman whipped out a notebook and quill and began jotting down the twins' names.
"Cheers," said George, taking the slip of parchment Bagman handed him and tucking it away into the front of his robes.
Bagman turned most cheerfully back to Mr. Weasley.
"Couldn't do me a brew, I suppose. I'm keeping an eye out for Barty Crouch. My Bulgarian opposite number's making difficulties, and I can't understand a word he's saying. Barty'll be able to sort it out. He speaks about 150 languages."
"Mr. Crouch," said Percy, suddenly abandoning his look of poker-stiff disapproval and positively writhing with excitement, "he speaks over 200. Mermish and gobbledygook and troll?"
"Anyone can speak troll," said Fred dismissively. "All you have to do is point and grunt."
Percy threw Fred an extremely nasty look and stoked the fire vigorously to bring the kettle back to the boil.
"Any news of Bertha Jorkins yet, Ludo?"
Mr. Weasley asked as Bagman settled himself down on the grass beside them all.
"Not a zicky bird," said Bagman comfortably. "But she'll turn up. Poor old Bertha. Memory like a leaky cauldron and no sense of direction. Lost, you take my word for it. She'll wander back into the office sometime in October, thinking it's still July."
"You don't think it might be time to send someone to look for her?"
Mr. Weasley suggested, tentatively, as Percy handed Bagman his tea.
"Barty Crouch keeps saying that," said Bagman, his round eyes widening innocently. "But we really can't spare anyone at the moment. Oh, talk of the devil! Barty!"
A wizard had just apparated at their fireside, and he could not have made more of a contrast with Ludo Bagman, sprawled on the grass in his old wasp robes. Barty Crouch was a stiff, upright, elderly man, dressed in an impeccably crisp suit and tie. The parting in his short grey hair was almost unnaturally straight, and his narrow toothbrush moustache looked as though he trimmed it using a slide rule. His shoes were very highly polished. Harry could see at once why Percy idolized him. Percy was a great believer in rigidly following rules, and Mr. Crouch had complied with the rule about muggle dressing so thoroughly that he could have passed for a bank manager. Harry doubted even Uncle Vernon would have spotted him for what he really was.
"Pull up a bit of grass, Barty," said Ludo brightly, patting the ground beside him.
"No, thank you, Ludo,"
said Crouch, and there was a bite of impatience in his voice.
"I've been looking for you everywhere. The Bulgarians are insisting we add another 12 seats to the top box."
"Oh, is that what they're after?" said Bagman. "I thought the chap was asking to borrow a pair of tweezers. Bit of a strong accent."
"Mr. Crouch," said Percy breathlessly, sunk into a kind of half-bow that made him look like a hunchback, "would you like a cup of tea?"
"Oh,"
said Mr. Crouch, looking over at Percy in mild surprise.
"Yes, thank you, Weatherby."
Fred and George choked into their own cups. Percy, very pink around the ears, busied himself with the kettle.
"Oh, and I've been wanting a word with you too, Arthur,"
said Mr. Crouch, his sharp eyes falling upon Mr. Weasley.
"Ali Bashir's on the warpath. He wants a word with you about your embargo on flying carpets."
Mr. Weasley heaved a deep sigh.
"I sent him an owl about that just last week. If I've told him once, I've told him 100 times. Carpets are defined as a Muggle artifact by the Registry of Prescribed Charmable Objects. But will he listen?" "I doubt it," said Mr. Crouch, accepting a cup from Percy. "He's desperate to export here."
"Well, they'll never replace brooms in Britain, will they?" said Bagman.
"Ali thinks there's a niche in the market for a family vehicle," said Mr. Crouch. "I remember my grandfather had an Axminster that could seat 12, but that was before carpets were banned, of course."
He spoke as though he wanted to leave nobody in any doubt that all his ancestors had abided strictly by the law.
"So, been keeping busy, Barty?" said Bagman breezily.
"Fairly," said Mr. Crouch dryly. "Organizing portkeys across 5 continents is no mean feat, Ludo."
"I expect you'll both be glad when this is over," said Mr. Weasley.
Ludo Bagman looked shocked.
"Glad? Don't know when I've had more fun. Still, it's not as though we haven't got anything to look forward to, eh, Barty, eh? Plenty left to organize, eh?"
Mr. Crouch raised his eyebrows at Bagman.
"We agreed not to make the announcement until all the details..."
"All details," said Bagman, waving the word away like a cloud of midges. "They've signed, haven't they? They've agreed, haven't they? I bet you anything these kids'll know soon enough anyway. I mean, it's happening at Hogwarts."
"Ludo, we need to meet the Bulgarians, you know,"
said Mr. Crouch sharply, cutting Bagman's remark short.
"Thank you for the tea, Weatherby."
He pushed his undrunk tea back at Percy and waited for Ludo to rise. Bagman struggled to his feet, swigging down the last of his tea, the gold in his pockets chinking merrily.
"See you all later," he said. "You'll be up in the top box with me. I'm commentating."
He waved. Barty Crouch nodded curtly, and both of them disapparated.
"What's happening at Hogwarts, Dad?" said Fred at once. "What were they talking about?"
"You'll find out soon enough," said Mr. Weasley, smiling.
"It's classified information until such time as the Ministry decides to release it," said Percy stiffly. "Mr. Crouch was quite right not to disclose it."
"Oh, shut up, Weatherby," said Fred.
A sense of excitement rose like a palpable cloud over the campsite as the afternoon wore on. By dusk, the still summer air itself seemed to be quivering with anticipation, and as darkness spread like a curtain over the thousands of waiting wizards, the last vestiges of pretense disappeared. The Ministry seemed to have bowed to the inevitable and stopped fighting the signs of blatant magic now breaking out everywhere. Salesmen were apparating every few feet, carrying trays and pushing carts full of extraordinary merchandise. There were luminous rosettes, green for Ireland, red for Bulgaria, which were squealing the names of the players, pointed green hats bedecked with dancing shamrocks, Bulgarian scarves adorned with lions that really roared, flags from both countries that played their national anthems as they were waved. There were tiny models of firebolts that really flew, and collectible figures of famous players which strolled across the palm of your hand preening themselves.
"Been saving my pocket money all summer for this," Ron told Harry as they and Hermione strolled through the salesman, buying souvenirs.
Though Ron purchased a dancing shamrock hat and a large green rosette, he also bought a small figure of Victor Crumb, the Bulgarian seeker. The miniature Crumb walked backward and forward over Ron's hand, scowling up at the green rosette above him.
"Wow, look at these,"
said Harry, hurrying over to a cart piled high with what looked like brass binoculars, except that they were covered with all sorts of weird knobs and dials.
"Omnioculars!" said the sales wizard eagerly. "You can replay action, slow everything down, and they flash up a play-by-play breakdown if you need it. Bargain! 10 galleons each!"
"Wish I hadn't bought this now," said Ron, gesturing at his dancing shamrock hat and gazing longingly at the omnioculars. "3 pairs, said Harry firmly to the wizard.
"No, don't bother," said Ron, going red. He was always touchy about the fact that Harry, who had inherited a small fortune from his parents, had much more money than he did.
"You won't be getting anything for Christmas," Harry told him, thrusting omnioculars into his and Hermione's hands. "For about 10 years, mind."
"Fair enough," said Ron, grinning.
"Oh, thanks, Harry," said Hermione, "and I'll get us some programs. Look."
Their money bags considerably lighter, they went back to the tents. Bill, Charlie, and Ginny were all sporting green rosettes, too, and Mr. Weasley was carrying an Irish flag. Fred and George had no souvenirs, as they had given Bagman all their gold. And then a deep, booming gong sounded somewhere beyond the woods, and at once green and red lanterns blazed into life in the trees, lighting a path to the field.
"It's time!" said Mr. Weasley, looking as excited as any of them. "Come on! Let's go!"
Chapter 8 The Quidditch World Cup. Clutching their purchases, Mr. Weasley in the lead, they all hurried into the wood following the lantern-lit trail. They could hear the sounds of thousands of people moving around them, shouts and laughter, snatches of singing. The atmosphere of feverish excitement was highly infectious. Harry couldn't stop grinning. They walked through the wood for 20 minutes, talking and joking loudly, until at last they emerged on the other side and found themselves in the shadow of a gigantic stadium. Though Harry could see only a fraction of the immense gold walls surrounding the field, he could tell that 10 cathedrals would fit comfortably inside it.
"Seats 100,000, said Mr. Weasley, spotting the awestruck look on Harry's face. "Ministry task force of 500 have been working on it all year. Muggle-repelling charms on every inch of it. Every time Muggles have got anywhere near here all year, they've suddenly remembered urgent appointments and had to dash away again. Bless them," he added fondly, leading the way toward the nearest entrance, which was already surrounded by a swarm of shouting witches and wizards.
"Prime seats," said the ministry witch at the entrance when she checked their tickets. "Top box, straight upstairs, Arthur, and as high as you can go."
The stairs to the stadium were carpeted in rich purple. They clambered upward with the rest of the crowd, which slowly filtered away through doors into the stands to their left and right. Mr. Weasley's party kept climbing, and at last they reached the top of the staircase and found themselves in a small box, set at the highest point of the stadium and situated exactly halfway between the golden goalposts. About 20 purple and gilt chairs stood in 2 rows here, and Harry, filing into the front seats with the Weasleys, looked down upon a scene the likes of which he could never have imagined. 100,000 witches and wizards were taking their places in the seats, which rose in levels around the long oval field. Everything was suffused with a mysterious golden light, which seemed to come from the stadium itself. The field looked smooth as velvet from their lofty position. At either end of the field stood 3 goal hoops 50 feet high. Right opposite them, almost at Harry's eye level, was a gigantic blackboard. Gold writing kept dashing across it as though an invisible giant's hand was scrawling upon the blackboard and then wiping it off again. Watching it, Harry saw that it was flashing advertisements across the field. The Blue Bottle, a broom for all the family, safe, reliable, and with built-in anti-burglar buzzer. Mrs. Scour's all-purpose magical mess remover, no pain, no stain. Gladrag's Wizard Wear, London, Paris, Hogsmeade. Harry tore his eyes away from the sign and looked over his shoulder to see who else was sharing the box with them. So far it was empty, except for a tiny creature sitting in the second from last seat at the end of the row behind them. The creature, whose legs were so short they stuck out in front of it on the chair, was wearing a tea towel draped like a toga, and it had its face hidden in its hands. Yet those long, bat-like ears were oddly familiar.
"Dobby!" said Harry incredulously.
The tiny creature looked up and stretched its fingers, revealing enormous brown eyes and a nose the exact size and shape of a large tomato. It wasn't Dobby. It was, however, unmistakably a house elf, as Harry's friend Dobby had been. Harry had set Dobby free from his old owners, the Malfoy family.
"Did Sir just call me Dobby?"
squeaked the elf curiously from between its fingers. Its voice was higher even than Dobby's had been, a teeny quivering squeak of a voice, and Harry suspected, though it was very hard to tell with a house elf, that this one might just be female. Ron and Hermione spun around in their seats to look. Though they had heard a lot about Dobby from Harry, they had never actually met him. Even Mr. Weasley looked around in interest.
"Sorry," Harry told the elf, "I just thought you were someone I knew."
"But I knows Dobby too, sir,"
squeaked the elf. She was shielding her face as though blinded by light, though the top box was not brightly lit.
"My name is Winky, sir. And you, sir?"
Her dark brown eyes widened to the size of side plates as they rested upon Harry's scar.
"You is surely Harry Potter."
"Yeah, I am," said Harry.
"But Dobby talks of you all the time, sir,"
she said, lowering her hands very slightly and looking awestruck.
"How is he?"
said Harry. "How's freedom suiting him?"
"Oh, sir,"
said Winky, shaking her head.
"Oh, sir, meaning no disrespect, sir, but I is not sure you did Dobby a favour, sir, when you is setting him free."
"Why?" said Harry, taken aback. "What's wrong with him?"
"Freedom is going to Dobby's head, sir,"
said Winky sadly.
"Ideas above his station, sir. Can't get another position, sir."
"Why not?" said Harry. Winky lowered her voice by a half octave and whispered,
"He is wanting paying for his work, sir."
"Paying?" said Harry blankly. "Well, why shouldn't he be paid?" Winky looked quite horrified at the idea and closed her fingers slightly so that her face was half hidden again.
"House elves is not paid, sir,"
she said in a muffled squeak.
"No, no, no. I says to Dobby, I says, go find yourself a nice family and settle down, Dobby. He is getting up to all sorts of hijinks, sir. What is unbecoming to a house elf? You goes racketing around like this, Dobby," I says, "and next thing I hear, you's up in front of the Department for the Regulation and Control of Magical Creatures, like some common goblin."
"Well, it's about time he had a bit of fun," said Harry.
"House elves is not supposed to have fun, Harry Potter,"
said Winky firmly from behind her hands.
"House elves does what they is told. I is not liking heights at all, Harry Potter."
She glanced toward the edge of the box and gulped.
"But my master sends me to the top box, and I comes, sir."
"Why's he sent you up here if he knows you don't like heights?" said Harry, frowning.
Master wants me to save him a seat, Harry Potter. He is very busy,"
said Winky, tilting her head toward the empty space beside her.
"Winky is wishing she is back in Master's tent, Harry Potter, but Winky does what she is told. Winky is a good house elf."
She gave the edge of the box another frightened look and hid her eyes completely again. Harry turned back to the others.
"So that's a house elf," Ron muttered. "Weird things, aren't they?"
"Dobby was weirder," said Harry fervently. Ron pulled out his omnioculars and started testing them, staring down into the crowd on the other side of the stadium.
"Wild,"
he said, twiddling the replay knob on the side.
"I can make that old bloke down there pick his nose again. And again. And again."
Hermione, meanwhile, was skimming eagerly through her velvet-covered tasseled program.
"A display from the team mascots will precede the match," she read aloud.
"Oh, that's always worth watching," said Mr. Weasley. "National teams bring creatures from their native land, you know, to put on a bit of a show."
The box filled gradually around them over the next half hour. Mr. Weasley kept shaking hands with people who were obviously very important wizards. Percy jumped to his feet so often that he looked as though he were trying to sit on a hedgehog. When Cornelius Fudge, the Minister of Magic himself, arrived, Percy bowed so low that his glasses fell off and shattered. Highly embarrassed, he repaired them with his wand, and thereafter remained in his seat, throwing jealous looks at Harry, whom Cornelius Fudge had greeted like an old friend.
They had met before, and Fudge shook Harry's hand in a fatherly fashion, asked how he was, and introduced him to the wizards on either side of him.
"Harry Potter, you know,"
he told the Bulgarian minister loudly, who was wearing splendid robes of black velvet trimmed with gold and didn't seem to understand a word of English.
"Harry Potter. Oh, come on now. You know who he is. The boy who survived you-know-who. You do know who he is."
The Bulgarian wizard suddenly spotted Harry's scar and started gabbling loudly and excitedly, pointing at it.
"Knew we'd get there in the end," said Fudge wearily to Harry. "I'm no great shakes at languages. I need Barty Crouch for this sort of thing. Ah, I see his house elves saving him a seat. Good job, too. These Bulgarian blighters have been trying to catch all the best places. Ah, and here's Lucius."
Harry, Ron and Hermione turned quickly. Edging along the second row to three still-empty seats right behind Mr. Weasley were none other than Dobby the house elf's former owners, Lucius Malfoy, his son Draco, and a woman, Harry supposed, must be Draco's mother. Harry and Draco Malfoy had been enemies ever since their very first journey to Hogwarts. A pale boy with a pointed face and white blonde hair, Draco greatly resembled his father. His mother was blonde, too, tall and slim. She would have been nice-looking if she hadn't been wearing a look that suggested there was a nasty smell under her nose.
"Ah, Fudge," said Mr. Malfoy, holding out his hand as he reached the Minister of Magic. "How are you? I don't think you've met my wife, Narcissa, or our son, Draco."
"How do you do? How do you do?"
said Fudge, smiling and bowing to Mrs. Malfoy.
"And allow me to introduce you to Mr. Oblansk. Oblansk. Mr. Well, he's the Bulgarian Minister of Magic, and he can't understand a word I'm saying anyway, so never mind. And let's see, who else? You know Arthur Weasley, I dare say?"
It was a tense moment. Mr. Weasley and Mr. Malfoy looked at each other, and Harry vividly recalled the last time they had come face to face. It had been in Flourish and Blot's bookshop, and they had had a fight. Mr. Malfoy's cold grey eyes swept over Mr. Weasley, and then up and down the row.
"Good Lord, Arthur," he said softly. "What did you have to sell to get seats in the top box? Surely your house wouldn't have fetched this much?"
Fudge, who wasn't listening, said,
"Lucius has just given a very generous contribution to St. Mungo's Hospital for Magical Maladies and Injuries, Arthur. He's here as my guest."
How nice," said Mr. Weasley, with a very strained smile. Mr. Malfoy's eyes had returned to Hermione, who went slightly pink but stared determinedly back at him. Harry knew exactly what was making Mr. Malfoy's lip curl like that. The Malfoys prided themselves on being pure bloods. In other words, they considered anyone of Muggle descent, like Hermione, second class. However, under the gaze of the Minister of Magic, Mr. Malfoy didn't dare say anything. He nodded sneeringly to Mr. Weasley and continued down the line to his seats. Draco shot Harry, Ron and Hermione one contemptuous look, then settled himself between his mother and father.
"Slimy gits," Ron muttered, as he, Harry and Hermione turned to face the field again.
Next moment, Ludo Bagman charged into the box.
"Everyone ready?"
he said, his round face gleaming like a great excited Edam.
"Minister! Ready to go?"
"Ready when you are, Ludo," said Fudge comfortably.
Ludo whipped out his wand, directed it at his own throat, and said,
"Sonorous!"
and then spoke over the roar of sound that was now filling the packed stadium. His voice echoed over them, booming into every corner of the stands.
"Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Welcome to the final of the 422nd Quidditch World Cup."
The spectators screamed and clapped. Thousands of flags waved, adding their discordant national anthems to the racket. A huge blackboard opposite them was wiped clear of its last message, "Bertie Bott's every flavour beans, a risk with every mouthful," and now showed Bulgaria 0, Ireland 0.
"And now, without further ado, allow me to introduce the Bulgarian national team mascots."
The right-hand side of the stands, which was a solid block of scarlet, roared its approval.
"I wonder what they've brought," said Mr. Weasley, leaning forward in his seat. "Ah,
He suddenly whipped off his glasses and polished them hurriedly on his robes.
Vela!
What a Vela! But 100 Vela were now gliding out onto the field, and Harry's question was answered for him. Vela were women, the most beautiful women Harry had ever seen, except that they weren't. They couldn't be human. This puzzled Harry for a moment while he tried to guess what exactly they could be. What could make their skin shine moon-bright like that, or their white gold hair fan out behind them without wind? But then the music started, and Harry stopped worrying about them not being human. In fact, he stopped worrying about anything at all. The Vela had started to dance, and Harry's mind had gone completely and blissfully blank. All that mattered in the world was that he kept watching the Vela, because if they stopped dancing, terrible things would happen. As the Vela danced faster and faster, wild, half-formed thoughts started chasing through Harry's dazed mind. He wanted to do something very impressive right now. Jumping from the box into the stadium seemed a good idea, but would it be good enough?
"Harry, what are you doing?"
said Hermione's voice from a long way off. The music stopped. Harry blinked. He was standing up, and one of his legs was resting on the wall of the box. Next to him, Ron was frozen in an attitude that looked as though he were about to dive from a springboard. Angry yells were filling the stadium. The crowd didn't want the Vela to go. Harry was with them. He would, of course, be supporting Bulgaria. And he wondered vaguely why he had a large green shamrock pinned to his chest. Ron, meanwhile, was absent-mindedly shredding the shamrocks on his hat. Mr. Weasley, smiling slightly, leaned over to Ron and tugged the hat out of his hands.
"You'll be wanting that," he said, "once Ireland have had their say."
"Ah!"
said Ron, staring open-mouthed at the Vela, who had now lined up along one side of the field. Hermione made a loud tutting noise. She reached up and pulled Harry back into his seat.
"Honestly," she said.
"And now," roared Ludo Bagman's voice, "kindly put your wands in the air for the Irish national team mascots."
Next moment, what seemed to be a great green and gold comet came zooming into the stadium. It did one circuit of the stadium, then split into two smaller comets, each hurtling toward the goalposts. A rainbow arced suddenly across the field, connecting the two balls of light. The crowd oohed and aahed, as though at a fireworks display. Now the rainbow faded, and the balls of light reunited and merged. They had formed a great shimmering shamrock, which rose up into the sky and began to soar over the stands. Something like golden rain seemed to be falling from it.
"Excellent!"
yelled Ron as the shamrock soared over them, and heavy gold coins rained from it, bouncing off their heads and seats. Squinting up at the shamrock, Harry realized that it was actually comprised of thousands of tiny little bearded men with red vests, each carrying a minute lamp of gold or green.
"Leprechauns,"
said Mr. Weasley over the tumultuous applause of the crowd, many of whom were still fighting and rummaging around under their chairs to retrieve the gold.
"There you go," Ron yelled happily, stuffing a fistful of gold coins into Harry's hand. "For the omnioculars. Now you've got to buy me a Christmas present. Ha!"
The great shamrock dissolved. The leprechauns drifted down onto the field on the opposite side from the Vela and settled themselves cross-legged to watch the match.
"And now, ladies and gentlemen, kindly welcome the Bulgarian national Quidditch team. I give you Dimitrov."
A scarlet-clad figure on a broomstick, moving so fast it was blurred, shot out onto the field from an entrance far below to wild applause from the Bulgarian supporters.
"Ivanova!"
A second scarlet-robed player zoomed out.
"Zograf! Levski! Volchanov, Volkov, and Crum!"
"That's him! That's him!"
yelled Ron, following Crum with his omnioculars. Harry quickly focused his own. Victor Crum was thin, dark, and sallow-skinned, with a large curved nose and thick black eyebrows. He looked like an overgrown bird of prey. It was hard to believe he was only 18.
"And now, please greet the Irish national Quidditch team," yelled Bagman, "presenting Connolly, Ryan, Troy, Mullet, Moran, Quigley, and
Lynch!
7 green blurs swept onto the field. Harry spun a small dial on the side of his omnioculars and slowed the players down enough to read the word Firebolt on each of their brooms and see their names embroidered in silver upon their backs.
And here, all the way from Egypt, our referee, acclaimed chair wizard of the International Association of Quidditch, Hassan Mostafa.
A small and skinny wizard, completely bald but with a moustache to rival Uncle Vernon's, wearing robes of pure gold to match the stadium, strode out onto the field. A silver whistle was protruding from under the moustache, and he was carrying a large wooden crate under one arm, his broomstick under the other. Harry spun the speed dial on his omnioculars back to normal, watching closely as Mostafa mounted his broomstick and kicked the crate open. 4 balls burst into the air, the scarlet quaffle, the 2 black bludgers, and, Harry saw it for the briefest moment before it sped out of sight, the minuscule winged golden snitch. With a sharp blast on his whistle, Mostafa shot into the air after the balls.
"They're off!" screamed Bagman, and its mullet. "Troy, Moran, Dimitrov, back to Muller, Troy, Levski, Moran!"
It was Quidditch as Harry had never seen it played before. He was pressing his omnioculars so hard to his glasses that they were cutting into the bridge of his nose. The speed of the players was incredible. The chasers were throwing the quaffle to one another so fast that Bagman only had time to say their names. Harry spun the slow dial on the right of his omnioculars again, pressed the play-by-play button on the top, and he was immediately watching in slow motion, while glittering purple lettering flashed across the lenses and the noise of the crowd pounded against his eardrums. "Hawkshead attacking formation," he read as he watched the 3 Irish chasers zoom closely together, Troy in the centre, slightly ahead of Mullet and Moran, bearing down upon the Bulgarians. "Porskov ploy," flashed up next, as Troy made as though to dart upward with the quaffle, drawing away the Bulgarian chaser, Ivanova, and dropping the quaffle to Moran. One of the Bulgarian beaters, Volvov, swung hard at a passing bludger with his small club, knocking it into Moran's path. Moran ducked to avoid the bludger and dropped the quaffle, and Levski, soaring beneath, caught it.
"Troy scores!"
roared Bagman, and the stadium shuddered with a roar of applause and cheers.
10-0 to Ireland!
What? Harry yelled, looking wildly around through his omnioculars. But Levski's got the quaffle.
Harry, if you're not going to watch at normal speed, you're going to miss things, shouted Hermione, who was dancing up and down, waving her arms in the air, while Troy did a lap of honour around the field.
Harry looked quickly over the top of his omnioculars and saw that the leprechauns, watching from the sidelines, had all risen into the air again and formed the great, glittering shamrock. Across the field, the Vela were watching them sulkily. Furious with himself, Harry spun his speed dial back to normal as play resumed. Harry knew enough about Quidditch to see that the Irish chasers were superb. They worked as a seamless team, their movements so well coordinated that they appeared to be reading one another's minds as they positioned themselves, and the rosette on Harry's chest kept squeaking their names,
Troy, Mullet, Moran.
And within 10 minutes, Ireland had scored twice more, bringing their lead to 30-0 and causing a thunderous tide of roars and applause from the green-clad supporters. The match became still faster, but more brutal. Volkov and Volkanov, the Bulgarian beaters, were whacking the bludgers as fiercely as possible at the Irish chasers, and were starting to prevent them from using some of their best moves. Twice they were forced to scatter, and then, finally, Ivanova managed to break through their ranks, dodge the keeper, Ryan, and score Bulgaria's first goal.
"Fingers in your ears!"
bellowed Mr. Weasley as the Vela started to dance in celebration. Harry screwed up his eyes, too. He wanted to keep his mind on the game. After a few seconds, he chanced to glance at the field. The Vela had stopped dancing, and Bulgaria was again in possession of the quaffle.
"Dimitrov! Levski! Dimitrov! Ivanova! Oh, I say!"
roared Bagman. 100,000 wizards gasped as the 2 seekers, Crum and Lynch, plummeted through the centre of the chasers, so fast that it looked as though they had just jumped from aeroplanes without parachutes. Harry followed their descent through his omnioculars, squinting to see where the snitch was.
"They're going to crash!"
screamed Hermione next to Harry. She was half right. At the very last second, Victor Crumb pulled out of the dive and spiraled off.
Lynch, however, hit the ground with a dull thud that could be heard throughout the stadium. A huge groan rose from the Irish seats.
"Fool!" moaned Mr. Weasley. "Crumb was fainting!"
"It's time out!" yelled Bagman's voice. "As trained medi-wizards, hurry onto the field to examine Aidan Lynch."
"He'll be okay. He only got ploughed," Charlie said reassuringly to Ginny, who was hanging over the side of the box looking horror-struck.
"Which is what Crumb was after, of course."
Harry hastily pressed the replay and play-by-play buttons on his omnioculus, twiddled the speed dial, and put them back up to his eyes. He watched as Crumb and Lynch dived again in slow motion. "Ronsky defensive feint, dangerous seeker diversion," read the shining purple lettering across his lenses. He saw Crumb's face contorted with concentration as he pulled out of the dive just in time, while Lynch was flattened, and he understood. Crumb hadn't seen the snitch at all. He was just making Lynch copy him. Harry had never seen anyone fly like that. Crumb hardly looked as though he was using a broomstick at all. He moved so easily through the air that he looked unsupported and weightless. Harry turned his omnioculars back to normal and focused them on Crumb. He was now circling high above Lynch, who was being revived by medi-wizards with cups of potion. Harry, focusing still more closely upon Crumb's face, saw his dark eyes darting all over the ground 100 feet below. He was using the time while Lynch was revived to look for the snitch without interference. Lynch got to his feet at last, to loud cheers from the green-clad supporters, mounted his firebolt, and kicked back off into the air. His revival seemed to give Ireland new heart. When Mustafa blew his whistle again, the chasers moved into action with a skill unrivaled by anything Harry had seen so far. After 15 more fast and furious minutes, Ireland had pulled ahead by 10 more goals. They were now leading by 130 points to 10, and the game was starting to get dirtier. As Mullet shot toward the goalpost yet again, clutching the quaffle tightly under her arm, the Bulgarian keeper, Zograf, flew out to meet her. Whatever happened was over so quickly, Harry didn't catch it, but a scream of rage from the Irish crowd and Mustafa's long, shrill whistle blast told him it had been a foul.
"And Mustafa takes the Bulgarian keeper to task for cobbing. Excessive use of elbows," Bagman informed the roaring spectators. "And yes, it's a penalty to Ireland."
The leprechauns, who had risen angrily into the air like a swarm of glittering hornets when Mullet had been fouled, now darted together to form the words, "Ha, ha, ha." The Vela, on the other side of the field, leapt to their feet, tossed their hair angrily, and started to dance again. As one, the Weasley boys and Harry stuffed their fingers into their ears, but Hermione, who hadn't bothered, was soon tugging on Harry's arm. He turned to look at her, and she pulled his fingers impatiently out of his ears.
"Look at the referee," she said, giggling.
Harry looked down at the field. Hassan Mustafa had landed right in front of the dancing Vela and was acting very oddly indeed. He was flexing his muscles and smoothing his moustache excitedly.
"Now, we can't have that," said Ludo Bagman, though he sounded highly amused. "Somebody slap the referee."
A medi-wizard came tearing across the field, his fingers stuffed into his own ears, and kicked Mustafa hard in the shins. Mustafa seemed to come to himself. Harry, watching through the omnioculars again, saw that he looked exceptionally embarrassed and had started shouting at the Vela, who had stopped dancing and were looking mutinous.
"And, unless I'm much mistaken, Mustafa is actually attempting to send off the Bulgarian team mascots," said Bagman's voice. "Now there's something we haven't seen before. Oh, this could turn nasty."
It did. The Bulgarian beaters, Volkov and Volkanov, landed on either side of Mustafa and began arguing furiously with him, gesticulating toward the leprechauns, who had now gleefully formed the words, "Hee, hee, hee." Mustafa was not impressed by the Bulgarians' arguments, however. He was jabbing his finger into the air, clearly telling them to get flying again, and when they refused, he gave 2 short blasts on his whistle.
"2 penalties for Ireland,"
shouted Bagman, and the Bulgarian crowd howled with anger.
"And Volkov and Volkanov had better get back on those brooms. Yes, there they go, and Troy takes the quaffle."
Play now reached a level of ferocity beyond anything they had yet seen. The beaters on both sides were acting without mercy.
Volkoff and Volkanoff in particular seemed not to care whether their clubs made contact with Bludger or human as they swung them violently through the air. Dimitrov shot straight at Moran, who had the quaffle, nearly knocking her off her broom.
"Foul!"
roared the Irish supporters as one, all standing up in a great wave of green.
"Foul!"
echoed Ludo Bagman's magically magnified voice. "Dimitrov skins Moran, deliberately flying to collide there. And it's got to be another penalty. Yes, there's the whistle." The leprechauns had risen into the air again, and this time they formed a giant hand, which was making a very rude sign.